So you want some more work to do with maps?
Yeah.
So you've done the homework already?
Yeah.
Okay.
I did it yesterday night and it was a lot of fun. It's quite weird, but once you get into it, it's pretty addictive again.
So you just want some more projects to do with it. You could look at last year's assignment. A couple of years ago, we did a... what's quite fun is to program a reverse Polish calculator.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, have you done that before in C?
Yeah, do it with the stack. I did in C. It's one of the KNR exercises.
Yeah, so that's a good one to try in MIPS as well.
Okay.
Because you've got to build a stack, but you kind of got the basics.
Is there any way of compiling C to MIPS and basically to see how whatever you write in C gets compiled to this that you can write?
You'd need a MIPS, a cross compiler for the MIPS. I'm sure you can. I don't know offhand how you do it.
Okay.
But I'm sure the GNU compiler will output MIPS code if you ask it to. And there is a way of getting assembly code from, say, GCC if you want it. I've seen it done. I can't remember how it's done. I'm not sure how you do it for MIPS, and whether like the GCC we have installed under DICE has the code generator for MIPS or not. You just have to sit around. So I haven't got other specific suggestions. So beyond projects with MIPS, I just say if you just want fun things to do, just go out with Google and see what's happening. There are probably whole courses on assembly language programming. Where
I Googled a bit for a couple of things, and basically the only context in which MIPS is ever mentioned is Stack Overflow, homework. People are always apparently forced to do it, and they do it like for fun.
Uh-huh. I haven't got. Sorry, I haven't got other things beyond those examples.
Checked out last year's assignment.
Last year, it's only marginally more difficult than this year. This year, we were asked to make things slightly more straightforward. So last year's is a little bit more involved, but there's conceptually there's really not much more there than. Well, I guess last year we got an opportunity to practice doing jump and link and return also from the same team. Okay. Do you have some deadline that's due?
Next hour.
Yes.
Not express the ones.
All right, let's get started. So hopefully you saw on the web already, or you got the email yesterday about the first MIPS homework. I heard from somebody that they've already done it, which is encouraging. For the rest of you, certainly please, if you haven't got started on it, start on it soon. And if you've got questions, come along to the labs and come along and post questions on the discussion forum as well. All right, today I'm going to finish off the last couple of lecture slides on the C programming introduction, and then we'll go on to talk a bit about logic design, and that will be a prelude to talking about processor design in the next couple of weeks. All right, so at the end of the lecture on C and C programming, we were looking at pointers, and the last couple of slides got examples of how you can have pointers to pointers. So we talked about pointers to, say, ints or pointers to structures. You can actually have a pointer which points to some data, which itself is a pointer which points to something. And this slide and next slide just walk you through an example of that happening. So we assume that we've got, let's just walk through how the text goes. So say we've got an array of strings. So at the top there, we see how you declare an array of strings. So remember, in C, if we want to talk about strings, strings are nothing more than arrays of characters. And if we want to, we can use array notation to talk about an array of characters, but we can also use a pointer into an array of characters to allow us to access the contents of an array of characters. That's what we've got up here. So we've got an array here, and the type of the elements of the array is char star, or pointers to characters. So when we declare an array like this, as part of a program, what we're doing is we're allocating in the in this case, if this were inside a function, you'd be allocating some space on the stack for storing the array of pointers. But you wouldn't be actually allocating any space at all for storing each of the strings which would be referred to by each of the elements of that array. So the question raised in this slide in the middle here is, well, at the top here we're saying, well, we want str table to be an array of 10 strings, but what if we want to have decided at the time the program's running how big the array is going to be, and maybe have it even changed as the program's executing? In that case, what we could do is we could declare this variable str table with the following type here, so char star star. So we read this as saying str table is a pointer to a character, or a pointer to a string. So let's see this in action on the next slide. Come on. Why is this frozen? Okay. Sorry, this is just frozen on me now. Come on, hello. Okay, here we go. All right, so let's walk through this example where we're looking at how you would set up an array of strings, an array of characters dynamically at runtime. So what we have, we assume to start off with that we've declared in our program a variable str table of this type star star char, or char star star. Here what we're doing is we're going to reserve some space on the heap now using this malloc function we talked about before for n pointers to strings. So we can assume instead of size 10, we're going to have size n. So n is some variable previously defined before this program segment that we see here. So we assume, so here we're saying we want to be storing pointers to characters. And here we're asking for the size in bytes of those. We're asking for n times that. So this, remember, malloc takes a number of bytes that you want to claim on the heap. And then we return from this malloc call, we return a pointer to str table. Sorry. We return a pointer which is str table. So this is a pointer to the beginning of this array of pointers to strings. And then what's happening down here is we're going to create space again on the heap for each of those individual strings. So we're going to index up through the first array here. And this case, choose to allocate space for strings of length L. And this time we're doing L times the size of a character. That usually just be one, but this is kind of the most informative way to write it. And then we're going to assume that we've got some string S set up somewhere, which is going to be the initial string contents that we want to put into each of these array elements. And we're going to copy from S. This copies from the second argument to the first argument. And so we're going to copy into str table I that the value, or that the pointer to character value is stored in S here. So what we've got here, this here and this here, if you remember from last lecture, are two equivalent notations for the same thing. We can use either in this case. So this loop here initializes each of the entries, and this is down here just a way of showing how you could, this is just showing notation if you want to access an individual character. If you want to take the ith string from the table and access the jth character, you could write this expression here. So in C, you do multiple dimensional arrays as arrays of one dimensional arrays. So that's why we can just stack the indexes like this. And this is another way that we can refer to that element using pointer arithmetic, this plus I and plus j, and dereferencing operators star here. So I got through that kind of quite quickly. That may be a bit hazy or fuzzy. What I recommend you try doing with this example is just kind of draw out some pictures showing what's happening at each line in terms of kind of memory being allocated and pointers being set to the different items. And if you've got any questions at all about those pictures, this is a kind of ideal kind of question to go to the lab with and ask one of the demonstrators. So just ask him or her, say, look, this is what I think is going on here. Have I got the right idea or not? All right, so that's just a introduction to kind of pointers to pointers. And then this is the final slide from last week. Just pointing out that, yes, it's a very brief, we've given you a very brief introduction to C. There's lots more there. There's a book called Kernighan and Ritchie, which is a quite old C textbook, but still an excellent place to start. Umpteen copies on reserve. You can still go out and pick up copies at the bookshop or on the net very easily. And you can work through that. There are also online resources, which I point to from the schedule webpage. But for example, things you might want to look at are how in C you print out messages to files or to the screen, and how you read in data as well from the terminal or from files. Those are kind of the next things you move on to beyond the basic constructs that you've seen here. And then you'd be able to just play with C and try writing some small programs. So if you've got some spare time and you want to learn some C, I encourage you just to go away and try just programming some just invent some exercise for yourself and just try and go away and program some things and see just to get a feel for what it's like, and maybe try doing some examples with dynamic data structures like you saw in those last couple of slides. All right, so that's the end of C. Let me move on now to the main topic for today, which is rapid but hopefully an interesting introduction to logic design. All right, I think I haven't, I didn't have time to put these slides up on the web, but these are pretty much the same as last year's slides in case you wanted to follow along at all. All right, so what we're going to do in this set of slides here is kind of walk through what gates look like and kind of work up to talking about basic arithmetic circuits like adders, and then talk a bit about how you build registers in logic and how they function. All right, so digital logic is all based around the idea of using voltage levels to represent logic values. So typically, we have a ground voltage, and we have which is say 0 volts, and a supply voltage. It might be 5 volts, it might be 2 volts, 1.3 volts. It really depends on what logic circuits you're looking at. But the idea is that a voltage level close to zero will say stand for will be the way in which we represent electrically a logic zero, and a voltage close to the supply voltage will be a way in which we represent a logical one value. We build then circuits using transistors, which are kind of basic building blocks of logic. They're essentially voltage controlled on-off switches. I haven't got time, and I won't go into kind of how you craft gates from transistors, but if you want to ask me afterwards, or you want to ask a TA or a demonstrator, please do. That's more something that you would find out in a double E course on logic design. With digital logic, yes, we use two voltages to represent zeros and ones. It's also possible to build what are called analog computers using analog circuits, so things like amplifiers, you've seen them, things like op amps. You can go so far, but generally, unless you're designing a very specialized kind of computer, you wouldn't design a computer using analog electronics. It's far, far more versatile to work with digital logic. Similarly, kind of just sticking in the world of digital logic, yes, we use two voltages to represent two states. There have been proposals for how to work with logic in which there are ternary elements, which are using three, say, voltage levels to represent a basic piece of information rather than two. And back in the 1940s, they actually, I think, built one or two computers like that. But very quickly, people found that it was easiest to just work with two levels. And so today, universally, digital computers are built just with using ones and zeros with the two states. There are two basic flavors of logic. There's what we call combinational logic, where the output, we draw a combinational logic circuit like this. That's the circuit. These lines represent wires. These are input wires here. Here we've got some output wires. With a combinational logic circuit, the outputs here are a Boolean function that dependent on the values on these inputs. But there's no memory in the combinational circuit. So these outputs always depend just on the current inputs. In contrast, more generally, there's what we call sequential logic. And sequential logic includes memory. So in a sequential logic circuit, the outputs here don't just depend on the current inputs, but they can depend on the previous inputs as well, because the circuit has memory of some kind. All right, we can start with looking at some of the most basic gates that you build logic from. Up the top there, we've got what's called an inverter gate or a NOT gate. One input, one output. Here, so a convention you'll see in several circuits, we use this bubble notation here on outputs, sometimes on inputs too, to indicate that a particular output or input is negated. So here with an inverter, if the input is a zero, the output is a one. If the input is a one, the output is a zero. And often we use, if we're thinking, doing logic design, this is the notation we use to indicate that a signal is inverted. We use a bar over the top of it. If we didn't have the bubble here, we would have just what's called a buffer. And the truth table would be input 0, output 0, input 1, output 1. Right, so inverters, the kind of simplest or the simplest kinds of gates we can have. Down the bottom here, we've got what's called an AND gate. Here's an example with two inputs, but you can have more than two sometimes as well. The idea here is the output is a logical one exactly when all of the inputs are also a logic one. So if we see this here in the truth table, the output is all zeros except for down here. It's a one just when the two inputs are a one. And a common notation here for logical AND is to use a dot or a multiplication symbol. So I imagine, am I right, when you did logic before, you used that for AND and that for OR? Are those the ones that you used last year? Okay, so in the kind of logic design EE world, it's much more common to use a dot for AND and to use a plus for OR. And instead of NOT, we use, instead of saying NOT X, we write X bar. All right, let's move on. So an OR gate. The idea of an OR gate is that the output is a logic one just when one or other of the inputs is a logic one, or perhaps both are logic ones. So that we're seeing over here. The output is a logic one when either in one over here or in two is a logic one. And here we're using the plus symbol here to show logical OR. Over here we've got what's called a NAND gate, a negated AND or not AND gate. Here we see the appearance of a bubble on the notation, the kind of graphic notation for an AND gate to indicate that it's very similar to an AND, except that the output has the opposite polarity. So the idea here is that the output is a logic zero just when both inputs are a logic one. So you see here in the truth table, a zero here just when the output two inputs are logic ones. And here we're using our notation using dot and an over bar to write the Boolean function for what the NAND gate computes. Everything good? Everybody following me? Yep, good. Let's keep going. Here's a NOR gate, same idea. So just as we get a NAND gate from an AND gate by negating the output, here we get a NOR gate from an OR gate by negating the output. And has exactly the truth table you'd expect. And here we have use of the OR notation and then the bar to indicate the Boolean function that's being computed. As I said, we can have gates which don't just have two inputs, but which have multiple inputs. And we use the same kind of graphic notation here. So for an AND, we have this straight line for the input. If you remember for ORs, we've got curved lines, a curved line for the inputs. And similarly, this is notation for AND, and here we've got notation for a multiple input OR. A circuit a little bit more complicated called a multiplexer. So the idea of a multiplexer is that it selects some input signal based on a control signal. So C here is a control signal. If the control signal is a zero, then the output Z is just a copy of the input I zero. If the control signal is a one, then the output Z is a copy of the input signal I one. So it's like a digital switch. C is the control, controlling whether Z is being, whether I one or I zero is being selected. Here, what we've done is shown a truth table for this circuit. So we've got three inputs. So here we're running through all possible combinations of those three inputs. And here we're showing the output. Over here, what is shown is an example of how we can use, how we can reason with Boolean logic formulas using this kind of notation, the dot, the plus, and the over bar. What's happened on the first line here is we have looked at the truth table and we've written down a Boolean function directly based on the truth table. So saying, well, the Z output is a 1 just for the cases of these four rows here, this row, this row, this row, and this row. So for example, here we're saying I0 is a 0, is low, I1 is high, and C is high. So that corresponds to this row here. And each of these other terms here corresponds to these other three rows here, here, and here, where the Z output is a 1. So this is something you should be able to do as well. Looking at the truth table, immediately write down a Boolean equation which describes what the table is saying. What's then been shown down through this set of equalities is how you can manipulate Boolean formulas. So for example, here we are rearranging the sum, rearranging the OR operators to bring terms which are similar together. So here we're bringing this term together with this one at the back. And similarly, we're grouping these two middle ones over here. Here we're doing some factoring. So we've got I1C common factor in these two arguments to an OR, and we're pulling those two common factors together. Similarly, we're pulling common factors I0 and C bar together here. Then we're just using a simple, to go from here to here, we're realizing that a signal or its negation is just is just logical truth, and then anding with logical truth just gives us whatever we're anding with. And so this expression simplifies to this, and this one simplifies to that. And now we have a very simple Boolean expression which expresses the same properties we've got up there, that if C is a logical 1, then this whole formula we just simplify to I1. If C is logical 0, then this whole formula simplifies simply to I0. So seeing how the multiplexer can be expressed as a simple Boolean expression. Any questions on that? The one, so just as a remark in passing. So one common simplification rule that's used is the following one, that A times B or C is equal to AB or AC, with a dot in there. And that's used over there. So here, as you see, I mean, you've got the same rule as you would have with normal arithmetic, although, of course, here, dot and plus mean something a little bit different. They're logical Boolean operators. The one rule that you've got with Boolean logic that you don't get with arithmetic is a similar one, where the plus, where the and the or are interchanged. So A or B and C. Usually we don't have to write the parentheses around B and C because we understand that the and binds more tightly than the or. But this is equal to A plus B and A or C. So this equation looks rather odd as an equation about arithmetic, but it's a completely valid equation of Boolean logic. And sometimes you might find when you're simplifying an expression or rearranging it that you want to use this law as well. So remember this law. And you've got other ones too, like you've got, you probably did the De Morgan laws last year. Yeah, so you remember things like A plus B negated is the same as not A and not B. A and B negated is the same as not A or not B. All right. Let's move on. All right, here's one example of how you might implement a multiplexer, how you might then put together some AND gates, an OR gate, and an inverter gate to construct a multiplexer circuit. So I encourage you to kind of work through this to convince yourself that this indeed carries out the logic that we saw before. Indeed, I mean, you can read that this. Actually, in this particular case, you can just read this circuit directly off the form of this formula here. Down here, there's just a remark. Here we're dealing with kind of simple circuits with 2, 3, 4 inputs, and then writing down these. So this expression here is sometimes called a sum of products form or a disjunctive normal form. Did you use that terminology before? Yes? No? Okay. So disjunctive normal form just means that you've got you've got pluses on the outside, and then you've got these terms here which are purely ands, and then the things they're anding together are just variables and negations of variables. So it's a kind of simplified form that any Boolean expression can be put into using rules such as these ones on the board. So if you've got n inputs, in general, these sum of products forms can involve 2 to the n products, which is going to be rather unwieldy if n's 10 or 20. All right. So here's an example of a more complicated circuit. This is how we might, this is the kind of symbol we use for writing down an adder circuit. This adder circuit takes 32 inputs A, representing some binary number, 32 inputs here, representing some other number, and has 33 outputs for the sum of those two inputs, so considering those inputs as kind of standard numbers in the way that we've seen before. And you would never try to write out a sum of products form for each of these outputs here in terms of these inputs. It just would be unwieldy. What we're going to see is how you construct such an adder circuit from simpler adder circuits. Here we've got what's called a full adder. So a full adder takes 3 inputs, A, B, and C, and computes 2 outputs, a carry output and a sum output. Essentially what it's doing is just adding together 3 bits, all of which have the same binary weight. So the idea is we get if we're just adding 3 binary digits together, we get a carry if at least 2 of those binary digits are logic 1. So you'll see that happens over here. We get a carry in this case, and this case. We get a sum output in 4 cases. We get a sum output when either exactly one of these inputs is a logic 1, or all 3 are a logic 1. So just to kind of show again what's happening is all we're doing is we're writing down, just doing a binary addition of A, B, and C, and we're getting a sum result and then a carry result as well in the next column. That's the kind of, that circuit is kind of performing this arithmetic function here. So if you're adding 1, 1, 1, you get a sum of 1 and a carry of 1, for example. Here we see the kind of truth table, which we walked through. Here you see how sum and carry are written as sum in sum of products forms. One very brief remark I'll make is with the sum, that this form here is not the most elegant way to write it. There's a further kind of gate. Anybody see a blackboard rubber lying around? Is it? All right, so shown on, not shown on those previous slides, is the definition of what's called a exclusive OR gate. Inputs A, B, and Y. The idea of an exclusive OR gate is that the output Y is high just when exactly one of the inputs is high, but not both of them. So that's sometimes called an XOR gate for exclusive OR. And we write sometimes, if we're using logic notation, we say Y equals A, we use a plus with a circle around it, B. And what's nice is that the sum for a full adder, the sum output can be written just as the input A, I guess we're using lowercase there, the sum is A exclusive OR B exclusive OR C. And a very nice property of exclusive OR is that it is associative, meaning just like with plus and with times and with and OR, it doesn't matter whether we put the brackets there or there. So when we write it, it's just convenient to leave those brackets out altogether. But this is a much nicer way to write sum because immediately you see much more transparently how sum is symmetric in the inputs A, B, and C, which is what you would expect. All right, let's move on. So here now we see how we take the basic full adder circuit, which is computing a kind of add for a single column of 3 bits, and how we just string them together to really carry out electronically or digitally exactly what you would do if you were doing a sum using pencil and paper. So what we have is we have a, on starting on the right-hand side, we ignore C0, the carry in, but we just add bits A0 and B0 to get a sum output S0. And then the carry from this addition just carries over to the column for the first bits. And now we add these three bits together to give us again a sum and a carry, which carries over, and so on, through a sequence of full adder bits until we get to a full adder for the most significant bits, A31 and B31, and that gives us a sum output S31, and then the carry there is just the output S32. So here, this is kind of how we realize in digital logic the basic principle of adding as we do using pencil and paper. So this is called a ripple carry adder because the carries, as we kind of move through the adder, are computed in sequence, one after the other. And you could almost picture a kind of ripple of ones or zeros propagating up through the carry chain after you've presented some new input to such a circuit. So as noted here, both the carries are computed in sequence, and so hence all the sum bits coming out appear in sequence from right to left as the carry ripples upwards, and as the whole circuit computes the values of successively higher output bits. So that's a ripple carry adder. It's not the best kind of adder you could construct. So if you had a, 64 bits you were adding, you'd have to go through 64 of these stages to compute the sum. And often we don't want to wait that long. We want some, so there are actually fancier circuits which use more logic, which will add much, much more quickly than using 64 stages. As here, we might only use, and for 64 bits, we might only use 7 or 8 stages of logic. But that's, I mean, if you want to find out about that, look in a textbook on logic design, and they'll show you many different ways of doing that. All right, so this is kind of discussion a bit about kind of this concept of propagation delay of circuits. So when we talk about the propagation delay of an AND gate or an OR gate, what we're talking about is the time delay between some input to that circuit changing and then the corresponding output of that circuit also changing. This delay depends on a whole factor of electrical factors, electrical parameters, some of them listed here. As computer scientists right now, at this level of abstraction, we kind of acknowledge that, yes, there are lots of factors. We don't worry about what they are too much. We just have some, what we kind of care about is perhaps just a general issue of, these simple gates have low propagation delays, they're fast, but if we have a whole chain of things, like with a ripple carry adder, then things can be much slower because we're having to pass a kind of logic signal and changes of logic signals through many stages in order to complete some calculation. And if somebody gives you delays for each individual logic element, you should be able to do simple additions to figure out what the delay is going through a whole chain of those elements. All right, moving on to sequential logic. So sequential logic is built from combinational logic in various ways. And the key idea is that sequential logic, unlike combinational logic, has feedback. So with combinational logic, say here, there's always a kind of movement of signals in one direction. You can always taking inputs and you're computing outputs, and then from those outputs inside the combinational logic, you're computing further outputs and so on. But this kind of idea of information, say, uniformly flowing to the right from inputs to outputs through the combinational logic. With sequential logic, what we do is we take some outputs generated by the combinational logic and feed them back around. And when we do that, we're actually able to create circuits which have memory. And now, as we vary the inputs and we look at the outputs, then these outputs don't just depend on the current inputs, but they depend on the values which have been fed back from these previously calculated signals here. Here's one of the simplest sequential circuits that you can construct. This one here is constructed from two NOR gates, and it's called a SR latch, or set reset latch. Here, so what happens, let's see, next slide looks at its function. I forgot to remark about what's up the top here. So this is just a kind of naive computation of how much memory there could be in a combinational circuit with feedback. That if we're feeding back n signals, then each of those signals could have either a logic 0 or a logic 1 on it. And therefore, there are 2 to the n possible combinations of kind of binary numbers or values we could be sending back if we've got n signals. And so that's kind of this potential size of the memory that we've constructed, that we could remember that we're in, that the circuit can remember that it's in one of 2 to the n different states. Continuing with the set reset latch, let's look at its logical behavior. So what's interesting about it is saying that quiescent state, both inputs say are at logic 0, but then there are 2 ways in which the circuit can stabilize. One way has this signal here, logic 1, this Q bar, a logic 1. So this is logic 1, we get 2 zeros here. And wait a sec, something's gone wrong. So if this is logic 1, we get a 1 and a 0 coming in here, and this here is a 0. And then the 0 feeds through here, we get 2 zeros on the input to this NOR gate, which makes this 1 again. So this circuit, the signals being fed back are computing logic functions, and the whole system just kind of holds itself in that state with this of 1 and this is 0 indefinitely if we hold those 2 inputs at logic zeros. Likewise, if this were logic 0 and this were logic 1, and these 2 inputs stayed at 0, the circuit would hold those values indefinitely as well. We have here a pseudo truth table. I say pseudo because usually you just use these for combinational logic, but here what we indicate that the output is being held by saying the output at stage I, when both inputs are 0, is the same as the output at some time step, I minus 1. So that's how we're kind of using truth table notation to indicate memory. But then what's interesting is that by momentarily taking this set input to a 1 and then a 0 again, say like here, if this is a graph over time, then what happens is we force the Q output to be logical 1. And from that point onwards, the circuit, after S has gone back to 0, the Q output will stay at a logical 1. However, if at some subsequent time, we have a pulse on the reset input going from 0 to 1 and back to 0, then the Q output will be set to 0. So this is a circuit which kind of remembers which of the set or reset inputs was pulsed to 1 last. So it's the most basic kind of memory circuit. One thing to watch with the circuit is we actually say its behavior is undefined if both the inputs are logic 1. In fact, if you put both inputs to logic 1, that will force both outputs to a 0. But so it kind of does do something, but now we're kind of outside the normal realm of operation. The normal operation, we assume such a simple circuit always has these inputs constrained so that both of them can never be 1 at the same time. So we really just care about using it with these 3 combinations, with these 3 first rows up here. All right. A slide briefly about different kinds of sequential logic. We can have what's called asynchronous logic or synchronous logic. In an asynchronous sequential logic, the outputs of the circuit respond immediately to changes on the input. In contrast, with a sequential circuit, we have a signal called a clock, which is a signal which is regularly switching between 1 and 0. And the idea is a sequential circuit, the clock really regulates how the circuit behaves. So only when, say, the clock transitions from a logic 0 to logic 1 are the inputs sampled and do the outputs change. That's shown down here. We've got, say, some input here, got a clock, positive clock edge here. And the idea here is that on this positive clock edge, maybe there's some examination of the current value on this input, and that causes a transition on the output from a 0 to a 1. In the next slide here, we see the most simple kind of sequential synchronous circuit. So from now on, all we're going to talk about are synchronous circuits. You can design logic, sequential logic, in an asynchronous fashion. It's more complicated. It's a delicate art, and it's not that common in current digital design. Most, I'd say, if you look at the design of logic in the computers that you use every day, 99, if not 100% of the logic is synchronous logic. This is the most basic synchronous logic element, called an edge-triggered or D flip-flop. It's got a data input, and a Q output, and a clock input. We use this funny triangle to indicate clock inputs often when we're drawing these graphical symbols for logic blocks. And the idea is, on every positive edge of clock, the input data is sampled and passed on to the output. And then between positive edges of clock, the circuit simply remembers that previously sampled value. So for example, here we've got a clock with three edges, one here, one here, one here. We've got data which is high on the first edge, low on the second edge and third edge of clock. So shortly after the first edge, the output goes to logic 1. Shortly after the second clock edge, the sampling is 0, the output goes to 0. After the third edge, input still is 0, so the output stays at 0. So this is like a sampling device. On the positive edge of clock, the input is sampled and held until the next positive edge of clock. This is a kind of basic memory device. Using it, we can make banks of these, so we can take a whole sequence of binary signals here, and we can all at once kind of clock a value from these signals into these flip-flops and then have that held value appear here. So this is, say, how we construct a 4-bit register, and this is a common notation we might use for that. Again, we're using this triangle to indicate the clock input. So we'll see next lecture, start to see how circuits like this are used to build up the elements inside a processor. This is a general synchronous sequential logic circuit then. What we do is we have combination logic here, and we've got a register bank here holding the current state of the sequential logic. And the idea is that the combination logic here computes based on the current state and the input, some output signals, and some next state signals. And every time we have a positive clock edge, then whatever is the next state computed here becomes the new current state here. I'm out of time, so again, what I'll do is I'll pick up this example here. There's some notes accompanying this lecture, which are up there from last year. I'll get them up for this year right after lecture. But what we've got here is a finite state machine. You would have seen finite state machines last year, yes? So you can build finite state machines in digital logic as using this basic architecture here. And so these last two slides walk through how you do that, and I'll go through them in a little bit of detail at the start of the next lecture. But out of time now, so I'm going to stop. Right, thanks very much, and please get started on the homework if you haven't got started already. Thank you.
Heard it on the coursework last
yes.
time,
uh-huh.
and I did the first question.
Good.
I've uh-huh. got like the question said that if we're using like Qt spam,
yeah,
it like when you press enter, it goes to the new line or it waits for a dollar sign.
Yeah.
But mine doesn't do that. Like mine, if I press enter, it just like sends an input.
Yeah. So it's the command line spim program that when you're running it from a shell, you have to hit the enter for. If you're using xspim or qtspim, then every time you type a character, your spim program sees it immediately. But it's an issue of buffering. So when you're typing things at a terminal, your program, which is reading from the terminal, actually doesn't see the data until you hit return. It's just the way that the terminal works.
No, but is that okay? I mean, or should I like redo it?
No. I mean, that I expect that you're going to see that difference in behavior, and so we won't. When we're marking, we'll be taking account of that. But you should certainly check, and you should run your program using spim on dice machines just to kind of check it works again, and you'll see that it'll work fine. But you just notice there's a delay. When you type the dollar sign, things don't happen. You have to hit the return to make things happen.
Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to ask is, do we have to, like, is it good if we put comments in the code? Because, like, I don't know.
Yes. I mean, if you look at the marking scheme, the assessment, I say the commenting is extremely important. I mean, that's a general factor with assembly code.
Okay, that's all. Okay. Thank you.
Sure.